Shattering Myths, I am Yada. Each weekday here on the Genesis Communication Network, we strive to expose the destructive and the deadly myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. They all seem to coalesce on Fridays when we talk to IQ Al-Rasuli in our second hour, as Western governments' interactions with and support and tolerance of and then occasional skirmishes against Islam intersect all of those criterion. During our first hour today, we're going to do what we would normally do in our second, which is we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant and through His always dependable Torah teaching, so that with His guidance we can replace religion with reason and engage in a relationship with Him. Our telephone number for any of you who would like to participate in this discussion, it is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, at the very end of the program, we had a gentleman call in, I believe it was from Philadelphia, that had many questions. He got two of them out. We answered one of the two, but since the answer to one of the two, I'm not sure, actually resonated with him, and it doesn't seem to resonate with Christians, although he made a some indication that he may have understood it. His first question was, he says, I know that the name Jesus Christ isn't accurate, but what do you say about him? You know, who was he? Why was he here? And my answer to him was that, well, when you come to understand that his name was not Jesus Christ, that Christ was not a last name, that it wasn't even an accurate depiction of his title, and that Jesus wasn't even invented as a name until the 17th century, that there is absolutely no correlation of any kind between Jesus and the placeholders for Yahusha, his actual name, that not only permeated the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, found in the Torah, found in the prophets, found in the Psalms, and the name of the individual who appeared on the scene in year 4,000 Yah to fulfill the Torah's promises, especially regarding Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, and with the Spirit's help, Shavuah, seven sevens, which is the next Moed Mikre on our not-too-distant horizon. That I said that understanding that his name was not Jesus Christ is half of the way home in terms of understanding who he is. But the moment you understand what his name is, once you know what his name is, Yahusha, and you know what Yahusha means, which is Yahweh saves, and if you know what the actual title that he bore was, which is Masayah, which means work of Yah, there's no reason to ask the question. The question is answered. I mean, simply by knowing his name and knowing what his name means, knowing his title and knowing what his title means, you know exactly who he was and why he was here. Yahusha, Yahweh saving us. Masayah, the work of Yah. And so the question just goes away. That's how important it is to understand his name. That's why the Christian religion, by changing his name, is so lost, so disconnected from the truth, so defiant in trying to force people into accepting their myth and their mythology. The second question that he asked is no more difficult to answer. He says, well, you know, what would you say about blood atonement and its ability to resolve sin? And my answer would be, in context with what? Do you think that blood atonement, if I go out and shoot a deer today because I'm an outdoorsman, is that going to resolve any sin? If I go off and shoot my neighbor because I don't like the color of the car he drives, is that going to resolve sin? If I slit my wrists, that's the letting of blood, is that going to resolve sin? And so I ask you, blood atonement and what context? What aspect of sin's consequence do you think it resolves? And once you can put it into context, your question is answered. Shedding of blood outside of the context of the Passover lamb is utterly and completely meaningless. Shedding of the Passover lamb's blood so that we might be nourished by the lamb, benefit from the lamb, is wholly meaningful. And so it's again the problem of religion. You're blinded to the connections that are essential to understanding, and it is by making connections that we understand. That's how we think. So blood atonement only when set into the context of Passover and the Passover lamb, when placed on the doorway to life, has merit. And even then, it does not resolve the penalty of sin. It resolves the consequence. The consequence of sin is death. Blood atonement, as it relates to the Passover lamb, provides life. If we rebel against God and that rebellion is not resolved, we die. Passover resolves that. You become immortal. If you respond to Yahweh's invitation to celebrate Passover, capitalize on what God is offering. But that won't get you home. Make you immortal. But being immortal and still being imperfect is the worst of all possible options. Because then you are not only destined to live forever, but you're destined to be separated from God forever. That's what Sheol, the abyss, was created for. So the penalty of sin, which is separation from God, has to be resolved as well for there to be a benefit from what the work of the Passover lamb, the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And that's what unleavened bread is about, where the yeast in the bread, which represents the fungus of sin, the corruption of sin, is removed. And it was removed by Yahusha's soul paying the price. Having our sin associated with him, he paid the price of separation from God, where his soul on the Shabbat went into Sheol to ransom us. Collectively, these two things get us two-thirds of the way home. We're now immortal. We are now perfect. But to be perfect and immortal and still not part of God's family isn't a desirable situation. You need all of these things to work in harmony. And so the third day, which is all part of the festival of unyeasted bread, the third day, we are adopted into God's family. That's what Bechorim means. Bechorim means firstborn child. We become firstborn into Yahweh's family on Bechorim. Those three things then work in harmony for us to become immortal, us to become perfect, us to become God's children. And the first three promises or benefits of the covenant are thereby fulfilled. On seven Sabbaths, which we will celebrate next week, Yahweh fulfills the promise of the next two, enables the promise of the next two, which is to enrich us and to empower his children. So that's the answer to the question about blood atonement. That is the answer to the question about who is Yahusha. Understand the terminology, understand the context these things are presented in, and they make perfect sense. All right, I want to return to Devarim words to discuss present what Moshe had to tell us about Yahweh as he was trying to summarize Yahweh's testimony. And as I share this first or this next statement with you, we'll begin to consider it. And then we have Nick calling in from Wisconsin. We'll entertain Nick's question this morning. This is now the fifth statement in the fifth chapter of Devarim. Face to face, Yahweh. Yahweh is God's one and only name. Face to face was written Pane Pane, or Pane Ba Pane. That means right in their presence. Face to face. Not hiding, conspicuous, right there in front of them. Yahweh. Yahweh is God's one and only name. He writes his name 7,000 times in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It is written using the same 22 characters. It happen to be three of those 22 characters that are in Yahweh's name. All three of the letters in Yahweh's name. Yes, I know there's four letters in Yahweh's name, but one of those letters is repeated, the He. They are all vowels. There are thousands upon thousands of words in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that we pronounce every day, whose pronunciation is known, that demonstrate how we are to pronounce each of the letters in God's name. For example, when we say Torah, which is one of the most commonly used titles in the world today, Torah explains how to pronounce the Hebrew the W, the Wah in Yahweh's name, and it also tells us how to pronounce the He at the end of Yahweh's name and at the end of both of the first syllable and the last syllable of Yahweh's name. Torah is written T-O-W, it's T-W-R-H, and the O sound is from the W, so T-W-R-H, the Ah sound is from the He. Same thing is true in Yahweh's name. Shalom, which is one of the most commonly repeated Hebrew terms. The greeting that is convoluted to mean peace, it actually means to reconcile a relationship. Shalom, the O sound in shalom is from the Hebrew wa. So face to face, Yahweh talked with you on the mountain from the midst of the fire. Esh, it's, he uses the term fire. It's radiant energy, light, glowing light. That's how God manifests himself in the midst of Mount Horeb, in the experience where he presented his Torah to Moshe. And so we'll return to this statement and then to Nick's question, which I understand is on Jehovah's Witnesses, as soon as these commercial breaks are concluded. We'll be right back. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Gold.
Good morning. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As promised, we're going to turn to Nick, who is calling in from Wisconsin, who has a question, I understand, on the Jehovah's Witnesses. Hi, Nick. Good morning.
Good morning. You know what? Said anything, I mean, busting the myth on what do they teach and why is it a lie? Because, you know, time to time they do show up in the front door and...
Yes.
My wife is afraid of them, and I'm really sorry for that. My connection, I hear that.
Okay.
Sound.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But,
yes, that's okay.
So could you...
Sure. Let me give you a little background on the Jehovah's Witnesses. The first thing, of course, in a Jehovah's Witness is, why would you say that you're witnessing on behalf of someone whose name you do not know? And, Nick, what I'm going to do here for a moment is I'm going to put you on hold just because of the static that's in the background.
I'll try to fix it, too.
Okay. The Jehovah's Witnesses, is my biggest issue with them just right off the bat would be, why would you call yourself witnesses of someone whose name you do not know? It is impossible for God's name to be Jehovah. There is no J letter, there is no J sound in the Hebrew alphabet. There never has been, there never will be one. So it is impossible for there to be a Hebrew name, Jehovah. Moreover, Yahweh writes his name 7,000 times in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And in addition to that, he provides another 250 names in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms that are based on his. And so you got to begin with, if you're not smart enough to figure out God's name, you ought not be pretending to be his witnesses. So that would be the start. His one and only name is Yahweh. Now, in the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's not only that they messed up with the J, not only that they messed up with the next sound and made it E-H, when God's Yahweh's Torah alone tells us how to pronounce the ah in his name. In fact, they pronounce it the first time eh and the second time ah, as if they haven't a clue that it's the same letter. And yet the Yah's Torah tells us how to pronounce it. God, when he introduced himself to us, not introduced himself to us overall, but when he introduced himself to Moshe, he told Moshe that his name was based on the Hebrew verb haya, which means to exist. Haya tells us how to pronounce the H in Yahweh's name. And so it cannot be eh. The third mistake is they have a V in the midst of Yahweh's name. There is no V in Hebrew. Now, to say that, somebody might say, oh, well, you know, now their modern Hebrew has, in many cases, changed the W sound to a V sound. And sometime around the last 100 years, there has been an effort to change the V to W to a V. However, in 100% of the words formed in the Torah's account, the wah in Hebrew is pronounced as an O. Now, they have an O in the middle of the name, but they supply the O sound with the letter V as opposed to a W. So they get everything wrong, and that's the big, that is their big claim. The Jehovah's Witnesses as a group, I guess around 20 million adherents, they are very evangelical in the sense that they love to go door to door, and thinking that winning souls is something that God wants us to do, and God doesn't. God simply says, I'm going to tell you about my covenant. I'm going to tell you about myself. I'm going to tell you about my invitations to meet with me. I am going to tell you that I don't want people to corrupt my message. I want you to share my message with your children. And if you wish to accept what I'm offering, great. If you wish to participate in what I'm offering, great. If you wish to reject it, that is your choice. If you wish to oppose it, well, then we're going to be foes. But that is an opportunity I'm going to give you to do. This idea of being evangelists is a Christian and misguided concept. There is one aspect of the Jehovah's Witnesses that is actually sane, and that is that they recognize that Christmas, Easter, and birthday celebrations have a pagan past. And while I don't think there's that big a deal with a birthday celebration, Christmas and Easter are purely pagan, and they are the holiest days on the Christian calendar. So they do have that right. So there are some things that they have right. Everything else they, I'm reading here, they reject the Trinity, and that would be appropriate. I'm told they reject also the immortality of the soul, and a soul is mortal, but a soul can become immortal, and they reject hellfire, and to the degree they recognize there is no fire in hell, that too would be accurate. But once again, you got to get the basics right. We'll return to this question after the commercial break. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are addressing a question that Nick, who's called in from Wisconsin, has asked regarding the beliefs of the Jehovah's Witnesses and the fact that they infringe on people's privacies by trying to impose their doctrine into people's homes. There are aspects of Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, there's aspects of almost every belief system that gets some things right. They do get some things right. They know that Christmas and Easter are pagan. They know that there is no such thing as a Trinity. They know that it is inappropriate for us to show allegiance to our country, and that the covenant requires us to disassociate from being dependent and being celebratory of a country. So there are aspects of what they teach that is accurate. They claim that their mantra, their raison d'etre comes from Isaiah 43, beginning at the 10th verse, which they, by the way, do not know that his name is actually Yeshayahu, which is troubling. And this is a statement that says, "You are my witnesses," declares Yahweh. Yahweh written the same way Yahweh is written each of the 7,000 times that it appears. And my servant whom I have chosen. Now, Yahweh is, if you look at the statement, he is speaking of the set-apart one of Yisrael. And he's speaking of the Messiah, Yahusha, being the most set-apart of Yisrael. And so, and he's talking about how everyone who is called by my name will receive his glory. And the fact is, the only people on earth that are actually called by his name would be Yehudim, not a Gentile organization. Much of the Jehovah's Witness mindset is based also on dispensationalism, that there are dispensations and Yah only has one dispensation. That is his covenant, period, full stop. And they also incorporate Paul's letters into their divinely inspired corpus of scriptures. And Paul was a false prophet. His testimony was overtly opposed to Yahweh and overtly opposed to his Torah, as well as opposed to Yahusha and Yahusha's disciples. The big issue, the big hiccup for Jehovah's Witnesses is twofold. One is in medical treatment, as I understand it, they oppose blood transfusions, which makes many operations in modern medicine unavailable to them. And they oppose it because they misunderstand the instruction that says, you know, we shall not consume blood. We shouldn't drink blood. Well, drinking blood, eating blood, and having a blood transfusion are entirely different things. God just says, you know, don't want you, when you slaughter an animal, prepare it for a meal, don't drink the blood. That's a very pagan kind of religious thing. Don't want you to do that. And so they get messed up there. And also they have presented themselves as the final Kingdom of God officiates, as opposed to Yisrael, which will be returned to that role. They said back in, I believe it was 1932-ish, 1925 might have been the date, that Abraham, Isaac, and I think it was just Abraham and Isaac, not Jacob. They don't want Jacob because Jacob represents Yisrael. That they would be resurrected. Still stuck in the ancient world, Nick, that there is such thing as bodily resurrection, and there is no such thing. And there is, of course, no indication anywhere in Scripture that Abraham or Yishak will be resurrected. They're very much alive. They're alive in heaven with Yahweh, but they're spiritual beings at this point. So, like so many things, a mix of good and bad.
I have one more question, if you
sure, go ahead.
Does the Torah have saying, teaching in does it have something similar to what Bible have, which is obey to the law of the land? Some similar saying. Does Torah have something like that?
Yeah. Torah means teaching. It's God's teaching. It's the term Bible is named after an Egyptian sun goddess. Yah's testimonies, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it is what you would find in what is errantly called the Old Testament of what is errantly called the Bible. Very poorly translated and misnamed, but nonetheless, that's where you'll find them. The submission to an obedience concept is not a Torah concept. There is actually no Hebrew word for obey. So you could not communicate an instruction in Hebrew, therefore cannot find an instruction in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that says, obey the rules of the land. Second, Yahweh's instructions throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is just the opposite. He routinely tells us, do not emulate, do not obey, do not adhere to the rules of and customs and religions and politics of other countries. Don't do that. So he tells us specifically not to do it as opposed to do it. There is a one person, however, that wrote in, I believe it's the 13th chapter of Romans, that we should submit to a government. And we should be accountable to government because this individual said that all government leaders were appointed by God. That individual happens to be Paul, who is the false prophet. So once you remove Paul from your consideration of divinely inspired texts, then you have one consistent message, which is don't obey. Don't subject yourself to. Don't emulate the practices of the nations, but instead listen to what Yahweh has to say.
Now, in your teachings, you talk about a lot about Yahweh's family and how he's going to save only those who's in his family. Would that mean that there's more than one family, that there's that Yahweh is not the only who have his family out there outside of this room? And why would I want to choose just his family and not the other ones? According to what the psychics and mediums out there saying each one of us have their own tribe out in the other room, which we go back to. And so Yahweh is probably the one out from those tribes. So
correct. Yeah, that would be, in fact, your illustration here, your context is really quite good. Yahweh is saying, I have one family. It's called the covenant. And the covenant family, I am the father of the covenant family. I have five conditions that you need to accept if you want to be part of my family, and I have five benefits that I'm offering my children, including that I will save them. And God is saying, as the first requirement of the covenant is that you have to walk away, not only from your country, but from your family. And so by saying that, it's obvious that God recognizes there's lots of families, lots of tribal adherences, lots of national adherences, lots of different kinds of ways that that humans congregate. And he's saying that in his family, you need, if you want to be part of his family, and he said, you know, it's your choice. I'm not going to force this on anybody. I'm inviting you, but I'm not going to compel you. If you want to be part of my family, you need to walk away from those other families.
Now, the God, Yahweh, wants to save you. And my question is, saving me from what? Is there no hail and fire? What do
he's
I
not
to be saved from?
Yeah, that's the reason why God's only interested in saving his children, and he doesn't actually use the term as often saving as he does redeeming, reconciling, enriching, helping grow, lift up. He uses lots of other terms. What God is saying is that if you choose not to participate in his family, you just say, I'm going to stay in my own little family. I like my world. I like my friends. I don't see any reason that I want to be part of God's covenant family. Then he's not going to save you, and there's really nothing to save you from, because at the end of your mortal existence, your soul is simply going to dissipate into nothingness. No penalty, no pain, no nothing. And when your life is over, it's just over. There's nothing to save you from. If you happen, though, to become part of his family, God has to do certain things on behalf of his children so that they can live with him in his presence forever. And that's what the purpose of, if we want to put it under the umbrella of salvation, that the purpose of that is to enable the covenant's children, those who choose to participate in the covenant, to be able to live with God forever. So what is the first thing you have to do? Well, we're mortal. You know, at the end of your life, if you choose not to participate in God's family, your soul simply dissipates into nothingness. So God's got to resolve that problem. He's got to make us immortal. That's what Passover is for.
But, well, I suppose nothingness is part, I mean, could be, well, would be a hell, sort of version of a hell for me, because, you know, I would hate to be, to die and just to be gone and done and yeah. to continue on, you know, let me
answer that before you go on. While it is a terrible waste of your soul to make that conscious decision that I don't want to become part of Yahweh's family, so I don't want to become immortal, that I'm happy to live my life apart from him and cease to exist upon my death. It can't be a hell for someone because you're completely unaware at that point. The only concept of hell in scripture is called Sheol, which speaks of questioning. Is there is once someone says they go the next step and they actually lead people away from God. They become religious and they lead people away from God, openly, actively, like your Jehovah's Witnesses, when they participate in misleading people. The place for them is Sheol, and it is eternal, but it's an eternal separation from God. That's not a place you want to end up.
But that's not what the mediums out there are saying, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they.
Right.
All over the
Correct.
Book, and they say pretty much the same thing, that you, after your death, you return to your own family. And, well, if the Yahweh is not part of my family, I just don't know which one, but I have my own there.
Yeah, no, what God tells us repeatedly is that spiritualists are lying. And so if you choose to trust the spiritualist, what you will end up being is ceasing to exist upon your death, because what they're saying is not true. And so that's the answer to that question. God spends a great deal of time warning us about listening to spiritualists. So if I were you, I wouldn't do it. To Shattering Myths. We've been talking with Nick, who's called in from Wisconsin, debunking the notion of Jehovah's Witnesses. But by the way, just one other quick comment on Jehovah's Witnesses. I had a chance to read a little more. It looks like they've lost about 90% of their congregation, and it's because, and as I mentioned briefly, in 1925, they said that Abraham and Isaac, Yishak is the actual name, means laughter, they were going to be resurrected. That did not happen. That was quite a problem for them. And then they also said that in 1975, the man whom they don't know, they refer to as Jesus Christ. Again, they don't know his name. They don't know his title. They said he was going to return in 1975. And when that didn't happen, all of a sudden they started to look like they were buffoons. And so they really lost a huge amount of their membership, from what I understand.
Now,
all right, go ahead.
Now, the concept, a very concept of the Torah's teaching, like, you know, I would save you if you learn Torah, if you know me, but if you don't, then I will not. It's like it's like saying I'll be saving a kid that my family kids will be running out on the highway next to my house.
Correct.
But if it will be a neighbor's kid, I don't know him, so I wouldn't save him. That's selfish, don't you? I mean, when you want to grow just your family in numbers, and you don't, I mean, in my mind, it's like he doesn't care about any other family or anything.
That's correct. He doesn't. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it like selfish and stuff?
No, you call it selfish. It's like a father. His priority is his family. If you want to be part of his family, he will give you everything he has. He will give you everything he has, which is the entire universe. And so that happens to be the antithesis of selfish. But he is only interested in enriching, empowering, making immortal, and perfecting, adopting his children. Those who choose to be with him. So if you choose, if you say, you know, I like those spiritualists. I think I want to be part of the spiritualist family. Have at it. You just can't. God's not going to allow anyone into his home that drags a bunch of religious, spiritual malarkey along with him. He just says, this is my home. I'm going to spend all eternity with these people. And the last thing I want is somebody in my home screaming out, Allahu Akbar. I'm not going to tolerate it.
Well, you don't need to invite me in my home. If you would save me and just, I mean, save me, you don't, I mean, send me back to earth.
Wait a minute. If you blew it this time, if you were given access to the truth and you chose not to avail yourself of it, why would it be appropriate for God to say, yeah, you blew it the last time. I'm going to give you another chance. Maybe next time you'll take me more seriously. What are the odds that you actually would?
Okay, what about those who have no chance? Those Amazons that don't even know
That's correct. That's why there's no punishment for them. They get to live their lives. They got the gift of life. They got the gift of free will. They got the gift of a conscience, and they get to live their lives. They get to enjoy their lives for as long as they live. And when it's over, it's just over. It's no punishment. That's the reason why there is no punishment for those who don't know God. There is none. It's like saying that my government gave me $1,000 welfare check for 20 years that I did not earn, and the 21st year they decide that they don't want to give me that welfare check anymore. I'm not being cheated.
Why create more then if you're not planning on saving it? Or Yahweh was the one who created it?
He created two humans with a Nesama, and he was absolutely fine with just those two. That would have been plenty good for him. Because all animals reproduce, and the reason that we were allowed to reproduce is so that more people would have the opportunity to come to know him. And so had he not allowed Adam and Chawa to reproduce, then I wouldn't have had the opportunity to come to know him. I'm delighted that he did. You wouldn't have the opportunity to come to know him if he hadn't allowed Adam and Chawa to reproduce. You have that opportunity. Whether or not you squander it is another story altogether. Glenn has called in regarding a question on translations of names. It actually should be transliterations of names, and we'll have to take that in the next hour before we engage IQ hours.
Thank you for talking to me.
Always a pleasure, Nick. Call in anytime. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break.
Many Americans suffer from digestive problems, often totally unaware they're not absorbing essential nutrients from foods and supplements. Dr. Peter Glidden is aware of the importance of healing.